unfortunately a tragic example of that the other day, but it happens every day. Texas has a worker fatality rate that's about twice that of California's, even though California, is, like Texas, has a complex range of hazardous industries with a lot of refineries and a lot of dangerous agricultural work. So there's a cost to that when we say we don't need regulations, we're saying we don't need safeguards of workers and the public. And I'm afraid people of Texas are paying a price for that.
Moving forward, what do you think is needed?
Well, for one thing, we saw that this plant had never been inspected since in the last 20-some years by OSHA. OSHA is drastically underfunded. They have a small staff of inspectors to cover millions of workplaces around the country. In Texas, for example, it takes about 100 years for them to inspect every workplace once. So it's possible for some really hazardous facilities to be completely under their radar. So we need a much better funded OSHA enforcement arm. We need to give OSHA the tools to be able to impose serious fines on employers who neglect their workers' safety. We need the ability to impose criminal penalties where there is an employer who willfully neglects to provide safe working conditions and workers die as a result. Right now, OSHA does not have that ability. Right now, all they can do is basically give an equivalent of a traffic ticket, a misdemeanor, to an employer who whose negligent actions result in a worker's death. So we need to change the Occupational Safety and Health Act to give OSHA some tools to really do their job effectively.
Do you know how the sequester cuts have affected OSHA?
What we've been told so far is that they are not reducing any staffing at this point, but that is still subject to change, I think.
Tim O'Connor is Executive Director of the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health, which advocates for worker safety and healthful workplaces across the country. And finally tonight,
freedom, 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 freedom.
Richie Havens, the folk singer and guitarist who was the first performer at Woodstock, died Monday at age 72. His family said in a statement that he died of a heart attack at his New Jersey home. He was born in Brooklyn. Havens was known for his unique guitar work and cover songs. His performance at the three-day 1969 Woodstock Festival was a turning point in his career. He was the first act to hit the stage, and his performance lasted hours because the next act hadn't shown up. His performance of Freedom, based on the spiritual Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child, became an anthem. A public memorial for Havens is being planned. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2013. The news was produced in New York with Jose Santiago, Rebecca Miles, and Linda Perry. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.
Sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone. Sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone. Sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone. Yeah, long, long, long way, way from my home, yeah, yeah. Clap your hands, clap your hands, clap your hands, clap your hands. Clap your hands, clap your hands, clap your hands, yeah, clap your hands. Hey, 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 yeah, 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 yeah. I got a telephone in my bosom, and I can call him up from my heart. I got a telephone in my pajama, and I can call him from my heart.
need my brother. Brother, I need my father. Father, hey, mother. Mother, hey, sister. Yeah, I need my brother. Brother, hey, mother.
Hey, this is Smokey Robinson, and you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, New York.
Let the music take your mind. Ooh, just release and you will find. You're gonna fly away, glad you're going my way. I love it when we're cruising together.
The weakest of all political demands is, give me something to vote for.
I'm occupying Wall Street because if you're not outraged, then you're not paying attention.
Of the economy.
I care deeply about what's happening to the country.
People are losing their homes.
I'm unemployed. I'm homeless.
My retirement literally embezzled.
Corporate banking behemoths rob the American people.
That ain't right, man.
Stand up and say, this is unacceptable and we're not going to take it anymore.
This country needs an enema. Well, the world needs an enema.
Hi, this is Eve Silber. Here is my guest today is Angud Bala, who is a filmmaker and is also an activist at Occupy Wall Street. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am really excited to talk to you. You have a film that's out this week. It made its premiere in New York City called Herman's House.
Yes, Herman's House is a film I've been working on for four and a half years, and it's about Herman Wallace, who spent over 40 years in solitary confinement, and his relationship with an artist, Jackie Sumrall, and their efforts to basically expose what's happening to Herman and other political prisoners in America through the design of his dream house. So it's this imaginative journey that you go on with Herman and Jackie, and in that way learn about his backgrounds of his case, but also that of the thousands of people in solitary confinement in the U.S.
As far as we know, Herman Wallace has been in solitary confinement longer than any other person in America right now.
As far as we know, but that all being said, these are not records that are kept very well. I mean, these are prison records that prison authorities, you know, would be happy to not have to keep at all. So this is, again, as far as we know, Herman is, yeah, he has been in solitary since April 17th, 1972.
And that alone would have been an interesting subject for the film. But what the film ends up focusing on is this project and the evolution of the project that Jackie gets in touch with him and begins a relationship with him through letter writing and sending him her art. And then she asks him a question. And she asks him what question?
Well, she asked him, what kind of house does a man who's lived in a 6-foot by 9-foot cell for over 30 years dream of? And it's a very provocative question, and I don't think she ever expected at that point that it would result in this, you know, award-winning exhibit that's traveled the world and now a documentary film that I directed based on, you know, about her project and kind of following her and Herman's journey. But it was a way, it really for her started just as a game. It's let me give something for Herman to think about outside of his confinement, outside of his cell. And then I think they realized that the political advocacy tool that it could function as.
Right. So now there is a goal to get this house that he imagined actually built.
Yes, then, you know, that's kind of when I got involved. I think it was, it was the summer of 2007, and Jackie had been, as an exhibit, it had been quite successful traveling to various galleries in various countries. And you know, the more she saw that success, I think the more she realized that, oh, imagine the possibilities if this was we actually tried to realize this dream and build the house as a community center for wayward youth in New Orleans. And so that was kind of kind of where I got involved, you know, and when I thought, oh, well, this might be an interesting kind of thread to follow, whatever happens one way or the other. Because firstly, I thought that, you know, it would be a way of talking about prisons, but not being necessarily inside the prison.
Were you a filmmaker before, or did this storyline trigger you to make a film?
No, I mean, it's funny because I've been a filmmaker and an organizer activist kind of for the last decade, and I really moved to New York thinking that I would get to make films and that would support my activism career, or that would support my activism. And for the first few years, I was being paid to work as an organizer, and the film was kind of my hobby. So it's always been something I've been doing, and I continue to do video for nonprofits and for unions and for groups that I agree with politically. I mean, I see film as a tool. But this, you know, this is my first feature-length independent film. So when I say independent, I mean, it's independent isn't that it's independent of the studios, but for me, it's also, you know, it was kind of my creative vision or my team's creative vision that was behind it, versus a lot of the work I do is actually for a client where, you know, whether it's the Center for Constitutional Rights or SEIU or whatever union, you know, we're working together, but it's their decision because they'll make the video at the end of the day.
And so it was a very interesting way of examining the issue of solitary confinement, which is a political issue. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I always, you know, Herman's case is unique in many ways. I mean, he was a Black Panther, he was an organizer, he was an activist, and he was trying to change the prison system in the 70s, and he was targeted for that. He was framed of a murder, and he was put in solitary. And there have actually been a couple movies already made about his case and all the flaws. And if you want to see, one of them is called In the Land of the Free. It's great. It tells you how the state went about kind of framing Herman Wallace, Albert Woodfox, and Robert King to try to silence them. They were all being politically active in the prisons. But for me, you know, the solitary confinement aspect was unique because it just, I mean, it's so absurd, but it also, to me, related to this ongoing kind of addiction in America around incarceration. You know, we've seen incarceration increase exponentially since the 70s.
And we're seeing solitary confinement increase.
Yeah.
Is this part of the profit machine of the prison industrial complex? Is there a profit motive for the use of solitary confinement in the way it's being used so much?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that obviously profit, when we have a private prison system, is going to play a part in it. Solitary confinement is much more expensive than...
Wouldn't that mean the vendors benefit from...
In some ways the vendors could benefit, but in terms of extracting profit margin, you know, if they can do it cheaply, then they have more room for margin, you know. But at the same time, I mean, I think it is part of that because, I mean, mass incarceration was always about disappearing people, you know, and you can make money off of disappearing people. And so what happened is we started building prisons and we started filling them up with people who were doing, you know, very, very minor crimes that shouldn't deserve prison sentences. And then it was like, well, if this is what the people who have a dime bag of weed are getting, well, what do we do with the real criminal? You know, what do we do with people who do something worse? They kept having to find more and more punitive measures. And then we landed up with, okay, well, let's keep thousands of people, up to 80,000 right now, in a box, 23 hours a day, 7 days a week. Let's keep them and hide them from everyone, even within the prison. They often call solitary the prison within the prison, because all the same, you know, unfortunately, racist logic that goes into the prison system goes into the solitary confinement system as well.
And when is it considered torture?
Well, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and so I don't, you know, the Supreme Court has, or the courts of the United States have ruled that it's not torture. It doesn't, they have yet to rule that this is a violation of the Eighth Amendment around cruel and unusual punishment. That being said, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, who actually himself was a political prisoner and held in solitary confinement, he stated that anything more than 15 days of that kind of sensory deprivation and being in solitary confinement amounts to torture. So, you know, but unfortunately, you know, torture, like all these other words now, are just thrown around. And I feel that, you know, morally, it's torture. And, you know, any way you look at it, there's no reason to have it. And but at the same time, you know, internationally now, that there is this argument that after 15 days, it is torture. And hopefully, you know, and that may help some of the legal cases in the United States that are happening right now.
And the extraordinary thing about the film, one of the extraordinary things about the film, is that Herman does not appear to be tortured, that he seems remarkably whole, given his circumstances. And at various points in the film, and I'm wondering for you as well, that he serves as a source of strength for the people who are trying to help him.
Yeah, Herman, it's funny because some people say, you know, Herman is really an exception in some ways, and he's a remarkable character. And people were like, well, will this work as a film about solitary? Because the majority of people in solitary go in totally insane. There are people with mental illness before they go in, and if they didn't have mental illnesses before they go in, by the time they've been there for a little bit, they develop mental illness. But Herman, I think, also gives a unique perspective on it because he's somebody you can relate to. And in the end, you need to be able to relate to people to build kind of an emotional connection to people. And once you build an emotional connection to someone, then you can start understanding this injustice. But so Herman, for him, solitary confinement, you know, was a political act on the part of the prison system to stifle his voice and his dissent against the prison system and the overall kind of capitalist structure. So he sees his staying sane part of that resistance. It's like every day he doesn't go insane in solitary means they are losing, right? But at the same time, it's not to say he's not impacted. I mean, Herman has arthritis. I mean, he hasn't walked, not being able to walk in more than, you know, 72 square feet other than that 1 hour a day is going to impact your body. Living in concrete, you know, and even the rest of his health is somewhat exposed in the film. His body does react to this. And part
of natural aging.
And natural aging.
He's 69 years old now.
He's older than that now. He's 71 now. That's just how long it takes for a film to get from completion to a distribution, which is a different story.
This film took 4.5-5 years to make. Was it part of the story unfolding that you wanted to capture that took so long? Or is this just how it is?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, it was probably 2 years of the story unfolding and capturing from the middle of 2007 to the middle of 2009. And then we had about a year of editing it and all the post-production between editing, music, sound, animation, all of those things overall took a year. And then I think fundraising, unfortunately, you know, the way the film system is set up right now, much of our film was foundation supported, and I'm very grateful to those foundations. I don't mean to say anything bad about them, but you know, it just takes time. They want to see footage before they kind of get involved, so it's this constant process. And this is a very odd film. You know, I respect anyone who put money into this film because, you know, we made a film about a guy you never see on screen. We made a film about prisons where you actually never enter a prison. You know, so, you know, the people who got behind it were our real champions. And I really, you know, honor them, Ford Foundation, Sundance Institute, lots of people. But, you know, I can understand. It wasn't an easy
so funding,
film.
We understand that here at WBAI as
yeah.
well. You are listening to Occupy Wall Street Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM New York. This is Eve Silber, and I'm talking with Angud Bala, the director of Herman's House, a documentary film that you should run out to see. Where can they see this right now? And it's also coming It's coming to theaters near you, but go ahead, tell them
how to support you. In theaters right now. It's playing at Cinema Village on 12th Street in Manhattan, and you know, fortunately or not, the theater system is very much a market-driven economy, so the number of people that see the film really has an impact on how many more people will see the film in other theaters and how long they will keep it on. So right now, it will definitely be playing through Thursday, April 25th, but it may stay longer if more people come see it.
I will tell you that this is a remarkable film. It is a wonderful film. It is uplifting at the same time that it is dealing with something extremely real and heavy, something very heavy. You made it very light. You made us fall in love with everybody in this movie. It's so much about the relationships. What makes you so interested in these relationships, do you think?
Well, you know, I just think that as a society, you know, we have learned to accept such, you know, inhumanity amongst, you know, that we inflict upon one another. And this isn't just in the prison system. We see it with unemployment. We see it with undocumented immigrants. We see it with any kind of marginalized group. And the more I was thinking about it, I realized that really, for this to occur, these people have to be dehumanized. And that's what's happened throughout history. For a society to kind of totally disenfranchise a group, they must be, you know, totally dehumanized.
And therefore, your task becomes to
exactly
humanize.
So it's very much that was my goal, is to make Herman a real and human character. And the best way to do that was through relationships, through his relationship with Jackie, with his sister, with other inmates, with people who knew him. And it's like, once you see him as a human being and you see everyone else as human beings, then we can start having an interesting political conversation about solutions. You know, I didn't think that was necessary to put in my film because, you know, that's...
The solution is really obvious. Let this man out.
The solution is obvious for me. Let this man out. But it's bigger than that. It's about, you know, we have 2.3 million people in prison in America and 80,000 people in solitary. And, you know, I would, you know, my personal belief is this, that system just doesn't function for anyone. It doesn't function for the people inside. And it doesn't function for the people outside. And we should come up with a solution together as a society. I don't have one necessarily that will fit everyone's ideas.
So in fall of 2011, you were deeply involved in the editing of this film and doing fundraising for yourself, and yet you found yourself in Zuccotti Park as well. What was that like for you? What brought you there? And tell us about your experience.
Sure. I mean, I was actually not here when kind of the encampment started. I was still in, we did a lot of the post-production in Toronto, and so I was watching it unfold, watching it, reading it, you know, via email. And so when I got back, it was October, and, you know, having been involved in protest movements and protest efforts in the city for years, I realized, okay, this is something different. How do we get involved? I had been a faith organizer for a long time, so I had lots of relationships with different faith organizations. I'd worked at Judson Memorial, worked with Riverside Church, all of these groups doing work. So I thought, well, this is a space that people of faith and faith leaders need to get involved in. And so that kind of was how I saw I could support it. And I think that at the time, you know, we just had been lacking and continue to lack, you know, having a broader discussion. And, you know, that to me was what Occupied really was doing. It was creating the space to talk about issues that have been marginalized by a kind of corporate-dominated media for a long time. So any way that we could support that, I felt that we should. And I felt that, you know, as people of faith, they had a specific role because this was a visioning process.
So that role maybe is part of the visioning, but since you're also talking about the act of humanizing and beginning these conversations, these relationships, is that something that the ministers of faith do in moments like this?
Definitely. I was very, you know, I was speaking to ministers and I said, look, these young people who have put their bodies on the line are living in the park, they're being demonized. They're being, you know, And we, you know, you have credentials. People look to you as leaders. And so if you stand with these people, like, they will, you know, that means something. And so it was part of that too. I mean, you saw the same way they've kind of destroyed any, tried to marginalize any movement, any kind of resistance, they'll dehumanize you. Oh, these guys are punks, they're, you know, they're homeless, this, that, you know what I mean? They're, or in this case, they're like, they're privileged, they're white, they're all of these issues. There's always probably some element of truth, but they're first, they're people. And the people that I met down there, some of them I knew before from other organizing, but, you know, they were trying to have a new conversation, or at least bring different ideas to the current conversation about the direction of the country and the economy.
And did anything about that action in the park and what happened afterwards surprise you?
I mean, what surprised me most was that I think for a lot of us was that the repression took so long. Like, there was repression throughout those whole few months, but, you know, we were there the night the park was cleared, and it was always not an if moment, but a when.
You knew we were just where to go. I remember that.
Well, I was trying, you know,
Foley Square.
There
was a plan.
There was a plan. I mean, I had always spoken to the leaders, the faith leaders, and I said, look, at some point they're gonna toss these people out. Like, it's just gonna happen. Hopefully, it won't be as violent as some of the other repression the state has done to these folks. But that's gonna happen. Like, we can't leave them out to dry. So I had, you know, we were up all night while it was happening, but I had already been talking to them that when this happens, we have to open up. We have to let people to stay in the churches and to say that they're not alone, to say that the city was behind them, at least some elements of the city. And that was, you know, that was important. And of course, we could, you know, I knew the churches couldn't turn into long-time shelters, but I think many of them for up to a week tried to at least maintain whatever they could, just volunteer support, but letting people stay there and open up those spaces.
And that made a big difference that night and the nights to follow.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think it was. You know, that's humanity. I mean,
that's humanity.
That's all we're trying to create. I mean,
when people say Occupy Movement Now, does it resonate for you? What does it mean to you? Where do you think the word fits in right now?
I think it will always resonate because you cannot deny the change in the conversation that period started, you know, had. And the impacts of that movement are not felt necessarily in the achievements or the lack thereof of that particular group of people. Because, you know, I do a lot of work with labor unions. And, you know, there is a different conversation post Occupy of reframing the how we talk about issues of inequality and issues of labor versus capital that you didn't see as much before, because I was working with them before as well. So I think that there will always be a lasting impact. I mean, there are still groups that are doing great work, whether it's Strike Debt, Occupy Your Homes, Occupy Faith still continues to try to bring that conversation into the, you know, into faith communities. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, we have these elections every few years that kind of are really set up to narrow that debate. So, you know, it didn't surprise me that the broad conversation quickly got narrowed because of the timing that Occupy happened, you know, in 2011, and then 2012 was an election year, and we were having like a debate a week about like how quickly we can deport undocumented, you know, like ridiculous things. And that's just the way that our political system is set up. But I mean, the conversation, you know, the genie's out of the bottle, as they
That's
say,
right.
You know, the conversation. So I'm still excited. I'm still excited by the possibilities. I'm excited by what a lot of artists that I met in Occupy are still doing amazing artwork You should totally check out Space Evaders if you haven't.
Uh-huh.
This amazing game that a friend Gan
created. The Tax Evaders?
Tax Evaders,
right.
Yeah. It's, you know, so like, yes, Gan was doing, like, people were doing this work before.
That's the work of Gan Golan.
Yeah.
Yes.
So people were doing it before, but it's like, it means something different, you know, and it's a different, you know, it's, that's continuing. So I think that
it's something recognizable.
It's something recognizable and
has a frame around it.
And I think, you know, you cannot, you know, like,